This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, February 26, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Alan Greenspan tells Congress to cut Social Security benefits, saying the country does not have the money to pay it.
It's the Bush administration that's determined to break it in order to privatize it and to provide his friends in the brokerage business a nice big lump of money to play around with.
And in an FSRN exclusive report, why has a group of universities covered up a cross burning on a campus in Los Angeles? But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. An armed resistance to President Jean-Bertrand Aristide is poised to rush the capital, Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Their leader, Guy Philippe, says they want to arrest Aristide on corruption and other charges. The Associated Press reports that Philippe says the attack is not imminent. The leader reportedly says, "We're just going to take our positions and wait for the right time." The United Nations Security Council is meeting over the crisis. Heather Risby reports from the UN.
The United Nations today deplored the Haitian opposition for rejecting proposals from the Organization of American States and Caribbean Community that could provide the basis for a peaceful compromise with President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The Council is due to hold an emergency meeting late in the afternoon at the request of Jamaica. The Council President said he did not know what the outcome would be, but added there were indications that Council may agree to send international police forces to Haiti, a proposal that came from the French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin yesterday. France has demanded that Aristide must step down, but the democratically elected Haitian president has refused to do so. The Haitian foreign minister is now due to have talks with Villepin in Paris tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
England spied on UN Secretary General Kofi Annan in an attempt to get a leg up on the world stage in the days leading up to the invasion of Iraq, according to a former minister. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
British agents spied on the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan. That's according to former International Development Secretary Claire Short. Ms. Short resigned in protest from the government in the lead-up to the invasion. She said today that she had seen transcripts of Kofi Annan's bugged conversations. The revelation follows the acquittal yesterday of former intelligence service worker Catherine Gunn, who was accused of breaching the Official Secrets Act by admitting leaking a US request for help from the UK in bugging the United Nations. Her lawyers believe the prosecution was ordered to drop the case because it went to the heart of issues of legality about the invasion in Iraq and the fact that the UK and the US were both involved in bugging undecided UN member states in the efforts to persuade them to support it. This is Naomi Fowler in London.
Residents in the nation's capital are calling for the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and their local government to declare a state of emergency in response to high levels of lead contamination in thousands of homes and more than 150 schools. In D.C., Ingrid Drake reports.
This morning, a group of Washington, D.C. residents, environmental activists, and public health experts launched the Lead Emergency Action for the District campaign. Demu Smith from the National Black Environmental Justice Network says authorities have been slow to act after two-thirds of the homes tested in D.C. turned up positive for excessive lead contamination.
The fact that officials in the know were slow to respond to a crisis of this magnitude in a majority black city smacks of environmental racism.
Lead poisoning can cause damage to the brain, nervous system, and internal organs. Especially vulnerable are children 6 years and younger and pregnant women. Mary Williams, whose household levels tested two times above allowable levels of lead, has been working with her neighbors to hold public officials accountable.
If one child is injured, or one child suffers any intellectual loss, or whose growth and productivity is impeded by this, just shame on all of us, because we cannot afford to let this continue to happen.
The group is also calling for comprehensive health screening for all residents, distribution of free water filters, and a top-to-bottom independent study of the extent of the problem. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake reporting in Washington, D.C.
Latin youth and other teens of color are far less likely to graduate from high school, according to a Harvard University study. Chuck Rosina reports from Boston.
New York has the worst statewide graduation rates of blacks and Hispanic students, according to a report co-authored by the Civil Rights Project at Harvard University. The report claims that Massachusetts was also among the 10 worst states with the largest graduation rate gaps between white students and blacks and Latino students. "We will never dissolve the hegemony of Jim Crow segregation unless we get serious about this problem," says Christopher Edley, co-director of the Civil Rights Project at Harvard University and co-author of the study released today. Nationally, 75% of white students graduated in 2001, which is the most recent statistic available from the U.S. Department of Education. According to the study, this is in contrast to the barely half of all blacks, Hispanic, and Native American students who entered U.S. high schools in 2000 will receive diplomas this year. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina in Boston.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Yesterday, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan told Congress that the government will be unable to meet its Social Security obligations in the near future. While supporting President Bush's tax cuts, Greenspan suggests cuts should be made to Social Security benefits sometime soon. Capitol Hill Republicans are using Greenspan's dire projection to promote private individualized accounts, which critics call a major step towards the privatization of the benefits program for seniors and people with disabilities. Mitch Jeserich, our D.C. editor, reports from Capitol Hill.
Alan Greenspan, the chair of the Federal Reserve, has such a mythic-like reputation both in Washington and Wall Street that a single sentence uttered by this sole individual can cause significant shifts in financial policies. That's why many people paid attention when he told Congress on Wednesday that a record budget deficit projection, coupled with a baby boomer generation ready to retire, will render the government unable to sustain current levels of Social Security benefits.
If changes need to be made, they should be made soon enough so that future retirees have time to adjust their plans for retirement spending and to make sure that their personal resources, along with what they expect to receive from the government, will be sufficient to meet their retirement needs.
Greenspan also told Congress it should act quickly because it may take several years to convince the financial markets that the cuts will be effective. Another option besides Social Security cuts would be to end President Bush's tax cuts that are set to expire. However, Greenspan gave the president a political boost when he said the tax breaks, primarily for investors, are helping the economy grow.
Tax rate increases of sufficient dimension to deal with our looming fiscal problems arguably pose significant risks to economic growth and the revenue base.
Still, the number of job increases expected with a growing economy hasn't been as fruitful as hoped. Senate Democrats are still trying to amend a bill that gives the gun industry immunity from civil lawsuits to include a provision to extend unemployment benefits. And Democratic Representative Danny Davis, who represents one of the poorest districts in Chicago, says additional resources and opportunities provided to low-income families will grow the economy far more than tax cuts for investors.
Give a person who makes $6.50 an hour another dollar. Now they're earning $7.50. They're going to put every penny of that $7.50 right back into some milk for the children, into some Pampers for the baby, into some child care, and the economy will then be able to feed on it, grow, expand, and develop. So I think we have a wrong-headed approach.
President Bush is using Greenspan's projection of a bankrupt Social Security system to promote his individualized retirement account proposal that would allow individuals to redirect a portion of the money they pay for Social Security and put it into a personalized account that they can control. The plan has a lot of support from Capitol Hill Republicans, including Senator John Cornyn of Texas.
I certainly at this point could not support any cuts in Social Security, but the problem he acknowledges is very real, and that is with the retirement of the baby boomers, we need to do something. And personally, I favor giving younger workers an opportunity to invest a portion of that money in something that pays better than a 1% rate of return, which is what Social Security does.
Critics of the individualized retirement account say it is a significant step towards privatizing Social Security and that the diversion of funds from the program will only further bankrupt it. Lila Garrett hosts a show at KPFK in Los Angeles called Connect the Dots. Garrett, who currently receives retirement benefits, says bankrupting the program has been the Bush administration's plan all along.
It's the Bush administration that's determined to break it in order to privatize it. and to provide his friends in the brokerage business a nice big lump of money to play around with. He will do for those firms, for Wall Street, what he did for Halliburton and for Bechtel. He will destroy a country so that they can go in and so-called save it. And for his friends in the brokerage business, his friends on Wall Street, he will destroy a system so that they can get their hands on that system's money. And that system is Social Security.
Garrett has her own projection that if President Bush wins in November, Social Security will be history. I'm Mitch Jezerich for Free Speech Radio News.
The news of the entry of civic activist Ralph Nader into the U.S. presidential race has caused some Democrats to groan and some Republicans to cackle with barely suppressed glee.
Free Speech Radio News commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal reporting from his cell on death row.
His announcement of his intent to run, this time as an independent rather than as a Green, evoked memories of the 2000 elections when the Bush camp stole Florida and the entire election by the foul disenfranchisement of tens of thousands of African-American, Haitian, and Jewish voters there. Nader has been subjected to the tearful pleas of liberals, as well as the veiled threats of others on the left, that he was a spoiler, and his entry into the race would virtually ensure the re-election of Bush. Underneath the pleas, the threats, and even the stifled laughter of so-called conservatives, lies the fundamental fear of democracy and the dismissal of millions of Americans from the very process. For them, the sentiment is, let sleeping dogs lie. They wish to simply accept the nation's electoral system as it is and try to extract the most votes from this group, which is, after all, a minority of the American majority. That is the sad state of American democracy. Nader's presidential announcement, made on network TV, quickly spread throughout the electric media and was slanted towards the spoiler angle. As ever, the media's addiction to conflict would only allow this kind of coverage. His principal motivation, as well as his principal complaints against both the Democrat and Republican Party, not to mention his critiques of the media, got shorter shrift. Nader's critique is identical to his 2000 run, that both major parties are in the capture of corporations, that while their rhetoric may differ, their actions and interests rarely do. Nader opined that even if Gore were president, the U.S. would have found a pretext to invade Iraq. To be loyal to any party, it must first be asked, how loyal is the party to you?
From Death Row, for Free Speech Radio, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Jordan's King Abdullah said yesterday that the Arab world has, quote, a lot to learn from Asia, and urged the Middle East countries to look east rather than to the west for role models in political and economic reform. This as Jordan and Singapore signed a free trade agreement that is not being received warmly in Jordan. Our correspondent Ula Farawati reports from Amman.
Jordanian independent analysts received coldly the news about Jordan signing a pact leading to a free trade agreement with Singapore. They said the pact is another media hype attempt by the Jordanian government and shall not contribute to the economic development in the kingdom. Mazen Marji is former president of Jordan's investment board.
The Jordanian economy will not benefit from this. Singapore has an export-oriented economy, and we have the opposite, so our local market will be flooded with cheaper Singaporean products.
Marji said the government has taken this step without considering the local working force.
The Jordanian laborer will be harmed, as labor is much cheaper in Singapore, and with the flooding of the economy, no more jobs will be created for Jordanian laborers.
Jordan has signed numerous FTAs with Arab countries as well as the U.S. and the European Union. Economic attorney Ghassan Ammar believes Jordan is going too far with signing a trade agreement with Singapore.
CANCUN, for example, has been a major incident worldwide whereby agreements from now on should combine the intents of the international community.
Muammar added that Jordan must encourage broader agreements that fit in the global agenda.
Some agreements actually that should be given priority are within the more neighboring countries in the region. I don't see that priority of Jordan now is to have bilateral agreements with countries as far as Singapore.
Analysts add that the Jordanian economy lags far behind the Singapore economy, and they view this as a big obstacle in the quest of the Jordanian economy to benefit from an agreement with a Far East country. In Amman, Jordan, I am Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Argentina today announced that a court order in the U.S. freezing some of the country's property in the Washington area has been lifted. The injunction was imposed this month by a Washington area judge at the request of NML Capital Limited, a Cayman Islands-based fund that's suing Argentina for $172 million in compensation for defaulted debt. The country's economic woes continue, with unemployment at 20%, while many in the workers' movements are questioning the policies of the so-called progressive President Kirchner. In response to the growing unemployment, the organized piqueteros blockades of bridges and major routes all over the country stepped up again last week. As Matt from the Autonomo Media Cooperative reports from Buenos Aires, thousands participated in the first organized roadblock against President Kirchner since the beginning of his administration.
Last week, several organizations of piqueteros blockaded bridges and roads all over the country. This is the first massive mobilization against President Kirchner since the beginning of his mandate. The piqueteros were in the streets again, reclaiming the following points: restitution of 250,000 cancelled social plans, cancellation of labor reform law, and against IMF agreements and civil rights reduction for local citizens. The piqueteros blocked the ticket offices, allowing passengers to travel for free, to demand better working conditions from the train company. The response of the government and the media generated a consensus of repression similar to the one before the massacre of January 26, 2002. The state, the justice and the media tried to isolate the social fighters. They tried to put the middle classes against the piqueteros, opposite to what happened in December 2001 when the middle class supported the demands of unemployed workers' organization. Carla from FTC said, "What the government has to do is to give jobs to the people if they don't want the piqueteros in the streets. It is a shame as to have to go to the streets to make noise so they listen and they give us something." At the same time that the road blockade was becoming a march to the legislature of Buenos Aires City, where different sectors of the society were protesting against the reform of the contravenal code. The new law pretends to be similar to the tolerance zero of the former mayor of New York, Rudolph Giuliani. This reform will consist in tougher laws that give more power to the police. The new law will affect especially young people, unemployed, prostitutes and transvestites. Sonia of AMAR, prostitute women organization, told us, "By the end of last year, the policemen started attacking our companions. The police act like if the new law was already approved. We was arrested, they attacked us and hurt us. Nobody cares because we are prostitutes. For the deputies, the prostitution is a libertinism, like saying that being poor is a libertinism. We say that no, that is not even a job. It's an activity that hurts us and ashamed us. We are women with no face for society. We are tired that the police stop us and request money from us to let us work." Leonardo, a young piquetero, told them, "They also want to make possible to jail kids of 14 years. It's not logical. The solution ain't the jail and repression, but that is the only way the system can continue." We can say that the day of road blockades and demonstrations were a victory for the social movement. They were able to do what they planned, even do the threats of the government. But the reality is that the government didn't give any sign of listening to the different demands. That's why the piqueteros are planning future actions. From Buenos Aires, Cooperativa Autonomía for Free Speech Radio News.
In a case that has attracted virtually no media attention, recently four students from the Claremont College Consortium which is situated just south of Los Angeles, burned a large cross on campus. The closely knit consortium consists of five colleges, from which two students from Harvey Mudd, one student from Claremont McKenna, and one student from Scripps stole a cross from the Pomona campus that was created as a piece of art. They dragged the cross back to the Harvey Mudd campus, where the 11-foot cross was set ablaze. Instead of calling the police, the school disposed of the evidence and kept the crime a secret. KPFK's Aura Bogado has this FSRN special report.
Marcelo Land Montaño, who attends Pomona College, created the cross last year as an art piece and displayed it in the courtyard outside his dorm until it was stolen and burned on January 9, 2004. It was not until January 22, 2 weeks after the cross burning occurred, that Marcelo was informed of what happened. He says that Pomona College didn't know the details soon enough to tell him about it, but he contends that Harvey Mudd College had reason to keep the facts covered up.
Well, my school didn't know that much about it first, and then I think the other school waited to tell everybody because I think they were hoping it wouldn't get out. And they got rid of the remains of my cross. They threw them away pretty quickly. I still wanted them back, so I think they sort of wanted to sweep it under the table.
Although Harvey Mudd College President John Strauss recently issued an email stating that the school condemns the act, students at the colleges were not informed of the incident until 3 weeks after it occurred. When they were told about it, school administrators stated that the cross burning was not a racially motivated hate crime and that the students had no awareness of how the act has historically been used to intimidate and oppress people of color. The Claremont Police Department has attempted to begin an investigation after hearing about the incident, but say they cannot go after those responsible since the colleges refused to hand over the crossburners' names. Nick Santino works with the United States Student Association. He says schools, including private institutions whose tuitions run about $30,000 a year, like the Claremont Colleges, have a vested interest in covering up hate crimes.
There's a lot of colleges and universities out there that really don't want acts such as hate crimes to be associated with their college campus. Primarily, there's a lot of administrators who are scared that the word will get out and that enrollment might drop or prominent donors may not wish to contribute to the university if it's connected to a hate crime. Really, the people who suffer in those types of situations and in those decisions are the students themselves, the folks who are directly affected by these hate crimes.
On February 6, less than a month after the cross-burning, Pomona College administrators found out that students attempting to join a social club known as OAD were given the racist option of taking, quote, a photo with 10 or more Asians, unquote, as part of their initiation process. Students at the colleges were informed of this discovery within days, and Pomona's incident response team gathered reactions from Asian American students who expressed rage. Ann Quinley is dean of students at Pomona College. She says that racially biased incidents are rare on campus and that those involving other forms of discrimination are more common.
It happens a little more homophobically, and I would say that most of the nasty writing on walls has been tearing down "I support gay rights" signs or writing "I don't" on them, or we had somebody write "fags are gay" in a shower stall. So I think that those kinds of things happen. When it comes to more really serious racial incidents where you have to feel like this is not young and stupid, this is incredible and stupid, I would say that we have not had a lot of those.
The four students involved in the cross burning, as well as members of OAD, are facing disciplinary action. The colleges assert that according to the law, they cannot disclose what their punishment will be. What is known, at least so far, is that no student has been suspended or expelled for their actions. Reporting from KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado for Free Speech Radio News.
Last month, countries sharing the Senegal River Valley gathered in St. Louis, Senegal, to discuss liberalization and research in the agricultural sector, two main obstacles to competitiveness and productivity. The high-level conference explored ways to set up a contract employment system that would work to benefit farmers, industrialists, investors, and the government, leaving out the many poor people who work the land. Further angering agricultural workers was the focus on the importance of research of biotechnology as a solution to the region's agricultural shortcomings. From Senegal, FSRN correspondent Njaga Sek reports.
The 7th Annual Subregional Conference on Agricultural Liberalization and Research was held at the University of St. Louis in the northern Senegal. The conference was attended by farmers, industrials, exporters and investors to launch a competitive sub-regional agriculture. The Senegal River Valley is known for its development of rice and millet, This year, the corn revolution in Senegal increased corn production to 500,000 tons, triggering a surplus of small farming activities, causing the corn industry to regulate the sector. Participants from Mauritania, Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, and Senegal lineate the role of governments to increase the role of investors and employees. Mamadou Sissoko, president of the Senegalese Association of Farmers, it's true that the government has given us some help, but we've always had private activities because we do a lot of investments. Research, vulgarization and organization of producers have been promoted in order to evaluate the socio-economic and environmental impacts in a context of privatization. Jean Zundi, a researcher from Burkina Faso, raises the problems of combining research and hiring farmers on contracts in Africa. When we talk about hiring farmers on contracts, it is related to a demand that is most of the time punctual, whereas research has a long-term vision, a strategic view of scientific supervision of an entire society. This poses a great deal of problems. WTO talks in Cancun last year left Senegalese farmers at risk due to competitiveness of the rice market, currently dominated by China and several Southeast Asian countries. To try and stimulate growth and compete in the global economy, Senegal has been encouraging farmers to seek alternative crops. Due to a lack of technological means, Senegal's agricultural sector is struggling to increase profits. But Landing Savané, Senegalese Minister of Industry, says that transformation of products is the real challenge. The transformation of our agricultural products is a challenge for the private sector, the government and the partners. Competitiveness is today the only condition to survive and develop, mainly in context of liberalization of exchange and open competition in products and markets. World Bank estimates that more than half of its agricultural projects in Africa have failed due to various infrastructure limitations. The agricultural sector is controlled by the Senegalese government. With a 48% unemployment rate and a slow economy, Senegalese farmers rely on the government for their standard of living. And while the men are seeking paid labor, the women are left in charge of the farms with no resources and a household also to manage. According to World Bank representative Pape Leopold Sarr, bridging the technological divide and producing contracts are ways Senegal can confront the global area. The bank agrees 100% with the chosen option, that is to use contracts in order to put producing organizations and the industrials they represent in the center of the agricultural sector. A rapid leap into genetic engineering raises biosafety issues in Africa. It makes African farmers dependent of European and American firms who hold the patents. Still, many think biotechnology is the solution. In Senegal, new Taiwanese quality rice, TCS10, is being experimented. It is genetically more resistant to dry climates. In Senegal, this is Njagasek for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Producers are Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Randy Zimmerman. Our DC editor is Mitch Jeserich. Technical producers are Jade Paget-Seekins, Lindsay Benedict, Pauline Bartolone, and Mick Million. FSRN is a worker-run collective. For more information, you can visit our website at www.fsrn.org. I'm Deepa Fernandez.